Afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 85th edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life, stories, and enduring hopes as New Mainers. Today, my guest is John Mutiala, originally from Hyderabad, India, born to academic parents in a family of four. He was among the last of the students to be educated by British and American missionaries. His life has been steeped in academia, and he is now an English professor right here at University of Southern Maine. And thank you so much for joining me today on New Mainers Speak, John.
Thank you, Kate, for inviting me to your show.
It's a pleasure. So how do you describe your childhood in Hyderabad, India? John, I wonder what it was like for you growing up in the big city before it became a big tech mecca.
I was born and raised in the city of Hyderabad. And after a couple of years, when my father became the principal of the Wesley School and College, we moved to the sister city of Secunderabad. And that's where I studied for almost about 20 years. Secunderabad was more laid back, quiet, very different from Hyderabad. We did have large military zones. There were contingents of the armed forces that used to be housed there. So we had entertainment centers, schools, and exercise arenas and things like that for the military folks. So Secunderabad had a different ambience and a different kind of culture almost. After finishing my schooling there, I went to the Arts and Science College in Secunderabad and then moved on to Osmania University in Hyderabad.
And what did you study there?
At the university?
Yes.
English.
And why English? And what called you to...
Yeah, English and American Studies. In Hyderabad, as a matter of fact, Kate, we had probably the largest library devoted to the study of American history and society called the American Studies Research Center that opened sometime in the late 60s, and Hyderabad was the capital of that kind of research field, so to speak. And I remember meeting with scholars from many parts of Asia, from Iran, from Pakistan, from Egypt, from Malaysia, from China, scholars who would come.
American scholars.
Yes.
Studying America.
Scholars studying American studies or American literature to this
place.
Do
we have something similar here in the United States that studies India? Center for Indian Studies?
Probably at the University of Chicago, and in a couple of other places. Interestingly, we do have the Confucius Institute at the University of Southern Maine, which seems to function at least partly in that way, although it might have a slightly more cultural focus. But that's a kind of new development.
I didn't know about that. In what ways could you tell as a young person that India had only recently gained its independence in, was it 47?
Yes.
Yeah.
1947. My parents may probably have a more immediate sense of colonial India, and my generation might have a slightly different sense of post-independence India. A couple of things come to mind. The formation of the new country. In 1947, India got independence. But the formation of the new state of India was a process fraught with conflict, threats, and compromise. I am from the city of Hyderabad. Hyderabad was a princely state ruled by the Nizam of Hyderabad. After 1947, interestingly, the Nizam didn't want anything to do with the new country of India. He wanted to retain autonomy. I think in 1948, the central government sent the Indian armed forces into Hyderabad, deposed the Nizam, and annexed the princely state of Hyderabad into the new Indian Union. Around the same time in the early 50s, we saw a concurrent movement of the poor and the peasants in the state of Andhra Pradesh, also the state of Hyderabad then, demanding autonomy, greater economic freedom, and things like that. Interestingly, last year in 2014, the demand for a separate state articulated in the late 1940s was realized because the state of Andhra Pradesh was split into two states, the state of Telangana and Andhra Pradesh, and today Hyderabad is the capital of both states.
Oh, wow. That's unusual, isn't it?
Very unusual.
It's like a Venn diagram.
Yes. And to think that the history of post-independence India is being played out even today in these very, very concrete political ways is telling.
My guest from Cameroon a couple weeks ago said something about when they were colonized, all the leaders, every leadership position from policeman to mayor to all the way up were all white people in a predominantly black culture. And I wonder if you saw a change in the leadership in post-colonial India, too.
Yes, and probably that flows across generations rather than happening in a pretty immediate, radical kind of way. Although the transfer of power was significant in that we had the Indian intelligentsia, the political leaders, the freedom fighters, who did come into power and assume a lot of responsibility and influence.
And personally, it also meant that your father became the principal of the school rather than the non-national choices.
Yes. And I do remember the other principals who were from England. They did command a lot of respect. They had done amazing work. And the role of missions in India also is a fascinating story, because many times Christian missions in India were working in ways that the East India Company did not want it to work. There were fundamental tensions between these two movements.
Was the education movement more about the people and the East India Company more about the profits?
Yes. If you had to break it down that way. There were times also when the British missionaries were banned from these places. Christian missions were having a very different impact in India. And there were some instances, probably in quite a few ways, where they tended to reify and reinforce colonial practices. That is something we should always keep in mind, in the sense that they were not a kind of pure radical alternative to British colonialism. But it is equally true historically that they were disrupting the flow of power, both in the colonial context in terms of the British Empire and in the Indian context in terms of the established social structures in place that were marginalizing other peoples, and who found the entry of Christian missions to be an opportunity for altering existing systems and finding different alternatives.
And the ramifications of that keep playing out.
Yes, to this day.
You described your coming to America as a classic American tale of intercontinental immigration. I love that quote. It's like rolls off the tongue of an English professor. So how was it that you ended up in Chicago to study? And can you tell us more about your rather amazing aunt that was there already?
My aunt, Sumitra Simpson, she's from Chicago. That's where she is now. She is the matriarch of our American family, if you will. She came to the U.S. in the late 60s. I still have a picture of her holding me as a baby just before she went to the airport to catch her flight to come to the United States. And as kids, we would get letters from her, postcards of Niagara Falls, beautiful pictures of the Washington Mall, the places that she visited in the United States. And she would always write the back of these cards, "I am going to get you here to the United States, but you've got to do a couple of things. Listen to your parents, study hard, and eat whatever is put on the table. Don't make a fuss, because you're privileged to get what you are getting on the table. So just eat well and eat your vegetables. Do what your parents say. One of these days, you're going to be coming to the United States, and I'm going to be getting you here." And that's exactly what my aunt did, Kate. Every person, every relative from my mother's side ended up coming to the United States, because at some point, my aunt started the process of getting them here. And I think every person also stayed with her in Chicago. So she's been a tremendous influence on our families, and she had married an African-American man, a Chicago police officer, Willie Earl Simpson, and they had a wonderful life of 30-plus years before he passed away in 2006. But both of them have played a tremendous role in our extended families.
I love that story. I think it is a classic American tale with a twist. And you've been in Maine then since about 2001, is
yes.
that right? And what brought you to Maine after studying in Chicago?
I finished my graduate studies at Loyola University and then worked for 1 year at Luther College in a gorgeous place
in
upper northeast Iowa.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful place. I was there as a visiting assistant professor. Then I got a job offer from the University of Southern Maine, and I took it. And Hannah and I have been in Maine since 2001.
Any impressions of how Maine was different from your other American experiences?
Yes. One of the first things that struck us was the weather. We were anticipating a harsher kind of winter, but we were pleasantly surprised, not in the sense of Maine's winters being less harsh or so, but the differences between Chicago, Illinois, and Maine. Chicago probably has about 30 plus inches of snow on average per year. Maine is somewhere around 62 or 65 inches. And it stays, and it stays in Maine. Although in Chicago, the wind can be brutal. And if you're waiting for a bus, if you're standing outside, sometimes it could be like 1,000 needles hitting you
in
your
terrible.
Face.
It's terrible. It's like a 5-degree wind tunnel.
Yes.
Yeah. You're listening to WMPG, Southern Maine Community Radio, broadcasting from USM. I'm Kate Manahan, and this is New Mainers Speak. If you're just joining us, welcome. My guest today is John Mutiala, author of Reworlding America and Dwelling in American. He was born in Hyderabad, India, now a professor of English at the University of Southern Maine and leading the charge in Maine on keeping the humanities relevant in the modern world. John, why are the humanities important to education, public policies, and the modern world?
A couple of things come to mind, Kate. The arts and the humanities and the social sciences, they offer us complex, holistic, and contextual ways of understanding historical and social change. The arts and the humanities offer us insights into the passions, the fears, the desires, the motivations, and the fantasies of people as they live, as they create things, as they interact and make meaning out of their lives. The arts and the humanities offer us histories, narratives, and artistic representations, if you will, of human labor and imagination. And the arts and the humanities are, especially in the context of the university, I think are fully committed, strongly committed to the free generation, flow, and exchange of ideas. Because the university is a unique place in society where any idea, any thought, any practice, however offensive, however disturbing, however problematic it may be, is subject to scrutiny and the exercise of both the critical faculty and the creative impulse. That, I hope, gives a sense of how the arts and the humanities and the social sciences could play an important role, both in the university and society.
Yeah, I'd say that's an excellent answer. More than I had expected. Better than expected. So you've been doing intensive research on digital humanities, and I wonder if you could tell us what that is and why it speaks to you enough that you would essentially retrain yourself in another discipline while continuing to offer courses in your original discipline of English. What is digital humanities?
That's a nice way of putting it, Kate, of retraining myself, because it certainly seems like that, and it's one of the best things for me, because it's like going back, learning things anew, learning to let go, accepting and acknowledging our ignorance and a need to study and learn with others. And that's the collaborative focus of the digital humanities, is absolutely wonderful and encouraging. To give you a sense of the digital humanities, a broader context would be necessary. A couple of things. Every minute of every day, 72 hours of video are uploaded on YouTube. 3,427 images are pinned on Pinterest. More than 200 emails are sent. 4 million queries are Googled. 277,000 tweets are tweeted on Twitter. And close to 2.5 million items of information are shared on Facebook. And this happens every minute of every day. Email accounts, for instance, are said to rise from 3.9 billion in 2013 to 4.9 billion in 2017. The total number of emails sent in the world in 2013 were 182.9 billion, which is expected to rise to 206.6 billion in 2017. I'm highlighting these figures to underscore two things. Digital technologies are pervading almost all spheres of social, political, economic, and cultural activity. And digital technologies are unleashing dramatic, profound, and disruptive change. And these two things directly impact the university. They impact the university because the university is a special place in society, that key designator, if you will, for the generation of knowledge, the examination of knowledge, the archival of knowledge, the dissemination of knowledge, and the learning of knowledge. And the digital transforms all aspects of knowledge generation, production, archival, and dissemination and learning. In that sense, many of the things that the university does, especially its mission and its purpose, are fundamentally impacted.
Yeah, it's really fractured the original mold that's been the model that's been used for eons.
Yes, yes. And it looks like we are only now getting a sense of how disruptive these technologies can be. And it does not mean that we have to jump on the bandwagon and start turning all face-to-face courses into online courses, or start offering the MOOCs, the massive open online courses that enroll people by the thousands. It doesn't mean that, although some people do tend to take that position. But it also does mean that we have to address these implications seriously. And the sooner we do that, the better off we will be, especially public institutions, because they play a very important role in society.
I think I get most excited about it as I learn about it, because it's kind of a tough concept. Still, they're the siloed kind of disciplines, but now they're working together with like a rainbow over the individual departments. And I don't know, maybe a network or a web kind of weaving, crackling kind of between all the different disciplines. And so what used to just firmly be cataloged into one discipline is now working more fluidly.
Yes.
Between the disciplines, right?
Yes. And the digital humanities, if I can encapsulate some of the critical energies, do three things. They use digital tools to study humanities subjects, and they use humanities values and insights and knowledge to study all things digital. They also give us tools to visualize and reimagine the data and the knowledge that we generate. And the digital humanities also give a public voice and presence for the humanities. And that can be done in order to highlight and reaffirm the significance of the arts and the humanities to civic life and civil society.
And that's what you've been working on, right? Some specific places in Maine have projects, and you've been applying this digital humanities concept to collecting and disseminating this information. Is that a fair way to put that?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
The project is called Digital Maine. I am principal investigator of that project. We have five mini projects going on. And all five of them focus particularly on Maine. One, for instance, looks at the rise of the paper plantations in Maine. The other one is documenting World War I memorials all across the state and developing metadata and tagging those things and putting them on the Digital Commons, which is our electronic database / digital repository for research. We have Envisioning Change that develops new visual ways of capturing the impact of sea level rise in Casco Bay. We have the Portland Women's History Trail that, as a group, we have developed a mobile application for that is freely available, by the way, at Google Play and iTunes. And we also have Maine Chance Farm, a project that is led by my English colleague who is looking at the Elizabeth Arden's Beauty Spa in Mount Vernon that had a huge national following and impact in terms of beauty culture. So she's documenting the histories of the folks who happened to work there.
Those are fantastic projects that really reach a whole bunch of different audiences, I would imagine. They're not all of the same kind.
Yes, and that's the third impulse of making the humanities, or rather giving humanities research a public presence and voice, comes into play. Like, for instance, the mobile application that we developed. that could be of immense use, both for researchers who want to look at the unique role that women played in Portland history, and also to tourists who flock to the state of Maine, especially to the city of Portland. They can use that application. They can actually walk the trails. There are 7 trails on that mobile app. And that's one way in which a humanities project gives, or rather highlights, the public role of the knowledge that we can generate within the arts and the humanities, simply by expanding access, by putting it in the public arena, and hopefully revitalizing the public imagination of Portland history and Maine history by extension.
I personally get kind of excited about that. It's not a dissertation on a shelf in a library somewhere that no one ever really reads. It's real and communicates with the public. That's beautiful.
Yes.
In short, what would be your best hope and dream for where this project might lead next?
We are thinking of extending this into what is now being referred to as the Iceland Initiative. This is something that our president, Glenn Cummings, is...
President of the university.
Of the University of Southern Maine. He is actively involved in leading this initiative. As a matter of fact, a few months ago, probably in October, he led a small delegation of faculty and researchers and staff to Iceland. They planned to open the new England Ocean Cluster House, modeled after the Iceland Ocean Cluster House. This Ocean Cluster House is supposed to serve as an incubator for startups, for businesses to focus on the fisheries, on biomedical technology, and things like that. And we hope to play some role in this initiative by working with the digital humanities.
That sounds exciting. And I'll be keeping an eye out for that. I want to take the Women's History Trail in the spring when it gets nice,
great,
too. John, you are so bright and alive. I can't imagine a better person to introduce a collaborative approach to understanding our world. You are an ideal person to reach out and build these bridges between unlikely partners with your solid understanding of the movement and your genuine curiosity for the world. Thank you so much for sharing your life and your work here with us today.
Thank you, Kate. It's wonderful to be here.
I'm Kate Manahan in the studio with my guest, John Mutiala. We will close today's program with a song he's chosen for us. Can you tell listeners a little bit about why you picked to share this song today?
This is a song written about Katrina. And we had worked with a lot of people in the Lutheran churches and other community organizations in Portland to send groups of people to New Orleans and the Gulf Coast to help in the rebuilding effort. So that's what this song is about.
And it is sung by John Mutiala. It's called Katrina.
Mississippi, as a child in Tishomingo, learning American history, how to love this land. The war took my father, my mother lost her way. I went to Louisiana, try to live it away. I played with Antoine Domino, became a cool cat on Blueberry Hill, jazzed up a cage who bore me a boy. I turned up the heat on the New Orleans sun. Hey, what a way to live. I was cool. Life was just great. Here in Louisiana, I could overcome fate. I was cool. Life was just great. Here in Louisiana, I could bump around faith. Then came Katrina, new girl in town, bringing it down, breaking up levees, tearing up lives. But thanks to Katrina, I ain't no super jack, just done poor and black. Oh, what a way to live. Now that I'm broke, now that I'm poor, when the waters are rising, the tears start to flow. Black. I am poor. Where the waters are rising, I don't matter no more. I am black. I am white. I am grown. Heavens are crying.